From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It's official. After an excruciatingly long wait, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, Joe Biden, chose his running mate, and it's California Senator Kamala Harris. Harris was one of dozens of women being carefully vetted by the Biden campaign and emerged early on as a strong candidate. She ran for president just months ago when she made one of the strongest challenges to Biden on the debate stage over his positions on racial justice. The Oakland-born senator, who was once Attorney General of California, had an Indian mother and Jamaican father who was strongly progressive. But Harris, who has been largely on the center-left of most issues, has her appointment with as Biden's running mate being met with either enthusiastic excitement or extreme derision from liberal and progressive circles. If Biden beats Trump in November, Harris will become the nation's first female, first Black, and first South Asian Indian origin vice president. We turn to Rosa Clemente. She's a journalist, producer, political commentator, and a scholar activist. Rosa identifies as a Black Puerto Rican woman born and raised in the Bronx, New York. For the last 3 years, she's served as a historical consultant to the forthcoming Ryan Coogler, Macro, and Warner Brothers film Judas and the Messiah, a movie inspired by the life of Fred Hampton, chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party, who was assassinated in 1969. She's also the executive director of the Black Latino Organizing Project and is currently completing her PhD at the W.E.B. Du Bois Center at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She was also the first ever Black Puerto Rican woman to run for vice president of the U.S. in 2008. On the Green Party ticket, she and her running mate Cynthia McKinney were to this date the only women of color ticket in American history. Rosa is also a news correspondent for our program. Welcome to the welcome back, Rosa.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So first, there's been a tremendous amount of attention that had been paid to who Biden would choose as running mate, almost as if this was going to make a massive difference. Do you feel that given that Trump is the one to beat, Biden's choice is significant, but only to an extent?
Well, definitely it's historically significant because she is the first Black Indian American woman to run for vice president on a major party ticket. And I do think that's important to acknowledge. And then really quickly understanding that she herself has called herself the top cop, the top prosecutor, and has built her whole career on prosecuting people. And until very late in her tenure, not prosecute people for what we would call quality of life crimes, especially marijuana in the state of California. So, you know, I don't think anybody is that enthusiastic, certainly the people I know around Biden, period, and now his vice presidential pick, which was something I think a lot of people were expecting, like Karen Bass, who I don't think is left, but definitely progressive, you know, was probably too much for Biden and all of that. And, you know, that's where we're at. We're still within a duopoly and people feel very limited in their choices. And there's people that have already declared that they're going to work to make, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris the next president, vice president of the United States.
He could have picked somebody like Susan Rice or Val Demings or Amy Klobuchar before she withdrew her name from the running. He could have picked somebody who was more right-wing than Kamala Harris. And if he had done so, he would have certainly been embraced by the establishment Democratic Party, but he would have certainly risked alienating those on the left of the party. Does Kamala Harris seem like a compromise choice? You know, not so left as Karen Bass or Elizabeth Warren, but not so right as Susan Rice?
Well, you know, I think these are terms that we have to look at now as maybe, you know, outdated, right, left, moderate. What does that mean? You know, unless you're going in there to dismantle the system, which would include dismantling the Electoral College and dismantling all the systems that are oppressive and racist, what it really comes down to is, obviously, people don't like Donald Trump. I mean, he's a megalomaniac. We have millions of names for who he is. But they still believe in the American presidency as something that is good. Then you have some of us who are like, the American presidency was never good and is never going to be good. A duopoly is not good. Most congressional people, senators being multimillionaires, it's not good, you know, and there's still not enough progressive, so-called progressives in the House to, I think, push people where they think Biden and Harris will go. And that was a mistake a lot of people made when Obama was president, to expect him to be progressive. And then we saw a lot of his policies to this day that are oppressive, not only here, but in the rest of the world. And I don't know if that is going to enthuse anybody, but those that already work within the electoral political project and a lot of nonprofits that have created PACs where they think this is going to be the saving grace from Donald Trump, which just even his policies on climate change, Biden's and hers, are not going to be good. You know, they're not going to be good for us.
Well, some have said that her position on climate change are a lot better than they were, and certainly better than Trump. For example, the Sunrise Movement's Varshini Prakash has, met Kamala Harris's announcement with cautious optimism, saying, you know, that while it's not ideal, it takes us closer to the idea of a Green New Deal than we've seen in the past. Then you've also got folks like Sean King, who is a left-wing journalist who had been quite critical of Kamala and then said that she was the most progressive candidate among the credible finalists for VP. He said that she's improved dramatically, drastically on all justice and policing related issues since she was last district attorney in 2011. Every year for the past 9 years since she left that position, she's gotten much better on justice reform. So there's some figures on the left that are credible and reputable who see Kamala Harris in a much more positive light. What do you think?
I mean, those are two people that, you know, examples of, and especially with Sean King, that I would not say they're left at all. Mm. They're not. You know, look, where we're at this moment is the people that are going to be enthused around the Democratic ticket are the Black and the Brown political bourgeois elite in this country, the ones that have access to resources, the ones that have large nonprofits, the ones that are getting multi-millions of dollars in this Black Lives Matter era. And what we're going to see is many of those same nonprofits and so many of those people that people mislabel being left, or certainly not of the Black left or the Black radical or the Black liberation movement in this country. And it'll be voices like mine and some of my other comrades that will be there, but that's not gonna be what, you know, our voices are also stifled at this moment because just of people also being obviously very afraid of Donald Trump and his administration during this COVID-19 crisis, where they're literally asking us to send our children to school as experiments. So what I would say right now is that the Democratic Party, as it has done before, has co-opted what we want. So Kamala's gonna say she's gonna want justice reform. We are saying abolish the system of policing. Both of them have already said they're not even going to entertain conversations around defunding the police, which means they're not going to entertain letting people out of mass incarceration or political prisoners. And now there is a new class of people in my generation and younger that are part of this elite political class and Black class. And, you know, I mean, I'm at the point, like, just say what you're about so that I can move in a different way with people who I think are truly progressive and radical people, you know. So it's, again, that kind of like two choices, and that we are always asked, particularly like, well, they're better than Trump. Anybody's better than Trump. Obviously, you know, a Biden and a Harris are better than maybe some of the other Democrats. But at the end of the day, they're not dealing with the material and financial conditions that most of Americans are. And I don't know if this is going to push especially a lot of younger people to vote in a very different way. That didn't happen in 2016. And, you know, I would never discount Trump and voter suppression and them. And I think that, and if she is Vice President, Senator Harris did say, you know, that we have to be very worried that he's already going to, has put out this narrative, the elections will not be fair and equal, you know, and I think that was something very important she did.
And just going back to the issues that Harris has taken positions on, Medicare for All is another one. She was one of the earliest signatories to Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill in the Senate. But then when she ran for president, she backtracked and she now has a platform, or if you can sort of find the cached version of her campaign platform, because now it just says Biden on it. She had a platform on her version of Medicare for All, which is sort of a watered down version. So, you know, and Biden has said that if by some miracle a Medicare for All bill passed the Senate and the House, that as president he would veto it, which is kind of sad to think about. You know, in the midst of a pandemic that we have, as the opposition party offering up to people who can't take a definitive position that Americans deserve taxpayer-funded healthcare, universal healthcare.
Well, yeah, you know, and the fact that they've already said that, what does that mean for getting our children out of cages? What does that mean for, you know, a debt-free college experience? But, you know, what it really, all of this, we can't speak about it without speaking about COVID. Whoever the president is going to, if it continues to be 45, I mean, we can be ensured massive more destruction of lives all over the world. That's all he's about, is destruction of human life and his administration. If the Democrats win, they have to go in there and implement everything that the people say that they want, and they can within those first 100 days. The fact that they already said they don't believe in Medicaid for All during a global pandemic should really open people's eyes. That what I think is the political difference is that people in the Democratic Party, those that run, you know, as Democrats for the most part, think that they're the ones that are going to fix the American presidency. This entire American project is built on enslavement, exploitation of labor, and the taking of lands. And until those things are addressed, it'll just be somebody else running the empire. And would it be better under Biden Harris? Yeah, you know, but that's where we're always been. And I think we have to have bigger imaginations of, I'm not here trying to just survive anymore. Like, we need to be able to thrive. Our children need to be able to go to school. We as parents shouldn't have to make an anguish decision of whether I send my child to school. I can do that. I have privilege to be able to keep my daughter here at home. Most of our people don't, you know, and I don't think either one of them, unless they really address that, but within talking about systems of reparations and redistribution of the wealth and healthcare for All, I don't think our conditions are going to be that much greater, especially with the flu coming and especially with the lack of testing. And I think people really are feeling, you know, the enthusiasm I'm seeing is from those that rally around those type of politics. I don't really see that.
Those on the left who are critical of Biden and Harris but want to see an end to the Trump regime say that, think about November not as casting a vote for Biden but as casting a vote against Trump. And then on day one of a Biden-Harris administration, being out in the streets or even earlier to continue to hold them accountable. I mean, is that basically the path for the left in terms of engaging with electoral politics?
You know, I would say no. I mean, it's not a path for me. Yes, we saw millions of people on the streets post George Floyd. And there's still been police killings, and there's still police pointing guns at four women, one a 60-year-old daughter. We're seeing videos of police taking masks off people, telling them not to wear. We see now one of these counties sheriffs saying that if any of his deputy wear masks, you know,
in Florida, yes.
You know, so no, I mean, obviously the path that Biden and Harris would have to take would be to literally employ, you know, all ideas and thinkers around what it looks to have not a, a sick health system, but a system that can keep you healthy. But that's already difficult for people to deal with when they've already said they don't want Medicaid for. So what does that mean? You know, obviously, I am with hundreds of million people around the world that knows that he has to go. But I also believe that there should be a path for those of us who are writers and thinkers and historians to say, we just don't have to accept something because it's slightly worse than something else. And that's why I'm not sure what enthusiasm means for people, particularly in mainstream media, not in progressive media. What enthusiasm, all the political pundits and their children that have the resources to stay home for the next year or have health care. You know, I think people have woken up to something in this country around literally having to making a choice whether I work or die. And so I'm more about what does that radical imagination of what we should all have look like? And we have to hold a lot of Black and Brown folks accountable for siding with particularly Democratic Party lines, as opposed to what the community is demanding.
Rosa, what about the new crop of young progressives of color that are, emerging and upsetting the establishment by winning seats in Congress through the Democratic Party this year, nearly two years after they were elected? All four members of the squad, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Ayanna Pressley, easily won their primary challenges, and really suggesting that the kinds of politics that they espouse, in addition to their identity, but I think more importantly, their values, resonate quite strongly with the American public. And then we had Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman, who might be the newest members of the squad come November.
Yeah, I mean, and right now, you know, particularly Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, that faced a hard primary, and AOC, and I would gather Cori Bush and Jamal when they go in there. And that's important. I mean, yeah, it's important that we have more democratic socialists and democratic leaning people that care about the human conditions of our folks, you know, but it's also set within something, you know, again, systemic that isn't meant to work with us. You know, we can also look at the number of Black elected officials we have now that have gone against the people, including Wesley Bell, who was a Ferguson protester who got in and became the DA off the people in Ferguson, the people that live there, the people that struggle, the people that die, the people that are in jail. And he had one final chance of trying to indict Darren Wilson, and he completely betrayed every Ferguson warrior. And we've seen that with Black DAs, and we've seen that with Black, particularly some of the Black women mayors, including Keisha Lance Bottoms, that, you know, castigated poor Black and Brown and white folks for being on the streets the beginning days of the protest, right? So, and also I would remind people, we've been here before. When there were no Black people, then there was a convention called the Gary Convention, where all types of Black folks came together and worked in operational unity to get Black people into office. And to this day, we can say one of them, Mayor Harold Washington from Chicago, was probably the most progressive Black Latino person of color we've ever had in any office like that. we've seen masses of Black and brown people get into office. What usually happens is that they're co-opted. Do I think that's going to happen with the squad? No, I don't think so right now. But they, none of them just want to be a congressperson for the next 30 or 40 years. They have higher ambitions, which is okay. So if you have higher ambition to be a senator or even a vice president or president, there's a lot of compromising you're going to have to do. And usually, again, that compromise comes off the back of our people. So although we speak about identity politics intersectionally wise, I think we have to be very careful now of just, you know, supporting any Black or brown person that's running for office, because that's how you get Wesley Bell. And that's how you get some of these Black DAs that are still refusing to stop, you know, incarcerating and going after young people, brutalizing them, putting them in juvenile hall, or still choking and killing them. Because we're seeing that happen every day still, post George Floyd's murder.
Rosa, do you, you know, in terms of how we ought to view electoral politics, of course, on the one hand, it is certainly not the only way to affect change in the country. On the other hand, we know that, for example, another 4 years of Trump wouldn't just, say, change the Supreme Court dramatically, but would also rain down such serious damage, more, you know, without another re-election coming up, the little ways in which he has held back, if at all, he will be free of. We can only imagine how much worse a second term would be compared to a first. So what's the wisdom that you want to share with our audience about the synergy between electoral politics and grassroots activism that needs to happen to change things for the better?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of our nonprofits and movement spaces are now hyper about electoral politics and have let the grassroots behind. It's also, you know, in this time period when organizing is really about human contact, and that we are dependent on technology to bring us together, something is getting lost in that, you know. But I do think, particularly for the last decade, there's been a lot of movements that have gone the electro-political route at the expense of, you know, engaging with grassroots. So there's a lot of echo chambers, there's a lot of particularly, you know, small group of people in comparison to the numbers that we need to be about grassroots organizing. But what I would say as an organizer is that in general, you know, you have to keep evolving. You have to check your previous assumptions. And, you know, for me being older now, almost 50, you know, I'm keenly aware that there is a new generation that includes my daughter in these streets. And I am supportive of that. And I'm also someone that would be supportive and continue to be supportive of particularly Black and brown young people who are finding their way in organizing. I don't think this is the time to be nitpicking necessarily. And I know some people may disagree, well, then that's not revolutionary. But what it really is like, I know what my lane is, and mine has really nothing to do with electoral politics anymore. You know, and I'm really about supporting my daughter's generation on the ground, who are really not talking, the 15, 16, 17 year old, they're not talking about engaging electoral politics. I think, you know, they've seen what happened under Obama and have the questions of like, how can Black Lives Matter happen when there's a Black president, you know? So I think her generation is keenly aware. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm definitely trying to be in solidarity with not just people here, but people all over the world that are really moving, and where I would like to see a lot of our people moving, holding entire governments accountable, and like they did in Lebanon, making the entire government resign, you know? And I think we have to be more international, more than ever, about how we do this work.
Well, Rosa, I want to thank you so much for joining us. As always, always appreciate your insight.
Thank you for having me, Sonali. Thank you.
My guest has been Rosa Clemente. She's a journalist, producer, political commentator, and scholar activist. She was the first ever Black Puerto Rican woman to run for vice president of the U.S. in 2008 on the Green Party ticket. She's also one of our news correspondents. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.